Welcome to the Diversity Remix, only provocative conversations at the intersection of business, politics, and culture. I'm Charlie Echeverry.
And I'm Jesus Chavez.
This week's episode, Fat, Fitness, and COVID. In our deep dive today, the connection between lifestyle choices and COVID has become a topic of deep contention and controversy. Is pointing out the connection that obesity and fitness have with COVID mortality a form of fat shaming, or are we following the science despite what social convention might suggest? And encourage or cringe, FEC rules on Hunter Biden controversy, a new potential Pinterest founder, and Facebook's little-known cross-check system. Did the Federal Election Commission finally put to rest questions of impropriety by social platforms in suppressing controversial stories? Or did they turn a blind eye to obvious inconsistencies in how the platforms regulate ideas in the wild? Is a recent lawsuit against the founders of Pinterest an opportunistic cash grab by an unscrupulous former associate? Or is it evidence of ungrateful founders conveniently ignoring those that helped them create a unicorn startup? And finally, is Facebook's moderation system creating a second-class citizenry by allowing millions of influential pages to operate under a different set of rules? Or is it a thoughtfully tiered system that ensures information with global impact is seen by all? This and more this week on TDR. Today's Hispanic Heritage Month.
It is.
Happy Hispanic Heritage Month.
And tonight is the celebration for Mexico Independence Day, right? El Grito.
That's right.
Tomorrow.
And of course, everybody knows that that's why we picked the middle of September
of course.
To start a month. What's your thought on Hispanic Heritage Month? Has it evolved for you?
I have a love-hate relationship with it.
I have mixed feelings too, but I think I've had mixed feelings for maybe years.
Yeah, I've always had mixed feelings of it. On the one hand, I could appreciate the opportunity to recognize the contributions of Latinos in this country and the history of it. I think that's nice. At the same time, it feels it always feels kind of contrived, and it ends up being this thing where a lot of people all of a sudden like it's important, but it seems all very superficial in my mind, and that's the part that bothers me.
Well, contrived, I think, is a good word. It also provides a really interesting, a really easy kind of foil or excuse or, you know, moment on the calendar to decide to do certain things that you might be doing otherwise throughout the year.
Right.
But it's a double-edged sword too, right? Because like in business, I remember having conversations about, well, we really shouldn't have a Hispanic Heritage Month sales package. Because every month is Hispanic Heritage Month, but then you realize, yeah, but these companies all set aside a bunch of money. If we don't go get it, why would anybody else?
Right.
And then you're like, find yourself building the package or the product, whatever it is, for that particular budget.
That's true. But I think that's kind of the problem, right? So much of what we're driven is driven based on consumer purchasing patterns, on advertising. And I think that's the issue. I mean, if I'm going to pick one that I really hate, it's Cinco de Mayo. I hate Cinco de Mayo. Like,
yeah.
There's absolutely nothing positive in my mind about that.
And nothing American.
There's nothing American. You're like, yeah, I guess not. I mean, there's nothing. On the Latino side, it's not at all related to, it's so far removed from what it actually represents,
right?
Which is the Battle of Puebla, which is this, for those that don't know, is the fight that Mexico had against the French.
The French, actually, that's what I mean. It's like, it's.
Won that battle, lost the war, but we won that battle.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what it sort of that day represents. But it's really more of a beer day, right? A day for Corona to spend a lot of money.
Manufactured beer holiday.
Yeah. And for people to dress like idiots. And in their attempt, air quotes, of looking Latino. So there's that, to me, there's actually zero value there because it really is not even recognizing the culture. At least you can say Hispanic Heritage Month. It may still feel a little contrived, but there is a much better attempt,
It's a much bigger umbrella, a much bigger tent. It's about all Latinos and recognizing the contribution.
Right, but I think there is that orientation of recognizing the culture.
That's
much
what I mean,
more,
yeah.
Right, where in Cinco de Mayo, like, hey, let's just go all get drunk, drink Mexican beer, and
it's a perfect comedy of errors because number one, it's an obscure thing that happened in the history broadly of countries that are not us. Number one, number two, people use it in a way to do something that has no relationship to that already kind of irrelevant event.
Right.
In other words, they, to your point, right, they use it to do something that has nothing to do with recognizing mm-hmm. that war or what happened in that battle or who the players were, mm-hmm. but it just becomes like a celebration excuse, which I don't know how that happened besides, again, maybe good commercialization of it. So yeah, that is a particularly egregious example.
I mean, I haven't asked someone that is Irish, but do they feel the same way about St. Patrick's Day?
No, because everybody likes to just get lit. I don't know. No, I'm just kidding. I have no
idea.
I mean,
I don't know, right? I mean, it's a little bit of the, I guess, a little bit of similar, although I got to imagine St. Patrick has a lot more like actual tie-in.
For sure. St. Patrick, I mean, that is his actual feast day, right? So the celebration of his feast day as a saint.
Yeah, but how many people like really care that it's actually St. Patrick?
I don't think.
Versus just
think,
like, I'm going to wear green and get completely hammered.
I think 86% of people have no idea that it's an actual person. Look, I mean, I think that's the case with cities like San Francisco and San Diego. Those are actually people. Los Angeles is named after a person, right? Mm-hmm. Our Lady of the Angels, like San Francisco, St. Right. Francis of Assisi. So people, St. Louis, St. Louis the Ninth was the King of France.
Right.
I mean, you know, also a saint. So I don't think people, I think the same people, same percentage know St. Patrick's as know those things. And it's a very low percentage, I would guess.
Yeah.
Probably the same percentage that would find no controversy in our deep dive today is the same percentage that knows all of these associated holidays and the patrons. Because it's a pretty dicey, or it can be a controversial issue. Right?
By the way, I was going to ask you, did you see any of these fights that happened over the weekend?
Which one?
From Thriller? It was...
Thriller, right?
Thriller, yeah. Not Thriller. Thriller. It was supposed
to be... I would watch it if it was Thriller.
Yeah, it was supposed to be Oscar La Hoya fighting, which he didn't because he got super sick with COVID. But it ended up being Holyfield versus an MMA guy, Vitor Belfort.
Oh, Vitor Belfort, yeah.
Yeah.
No,
which I didn't actually know who he was.
It was a boxing match?
I heard his name, but I never...
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, classic MMA guy.
Yeah, it was a boxing match. It was that one also who fought earlier.
Who won?
The day. Wait, I'll tell you right now. It was so though they fought. You also had I'm blanking on both those guys.
You blank? Come on.
Yeah, I know. That's terrible. So. Silva, yeah. Anderson Silva versus Ortiz, who was also MMA.
Tito Ortiz.
The whole thing.
Oh, I did see that. I did see a clip from that.
Was so embarrassing.
Anderson
Charlie.
Silva knocked him out.
Yeah,
right?
But the whole thing is embarrassing. I mean, all of it, up and down.
Right.
I mean, looking at the Anderson Silva versus Tito Ortiz fight, Tito looked like he never fought a day of his life. It's like some of these MMA guys are so awkward boxing. It's like they have no idea what's happening. It's like literally it's the first time they ever received boxing gloves is the second they're walking into the ring.
Boxing isn't fighting.
That's right. It's just a very different sport. So it's, I mean, at this point, it's getting so ridiculous.
Yeah.
And you see some of these fights. The whole thing with Holyfield versus Belfort. I mean, Holyfield got knocked out like immediately. The dude, he swung and almost knocked himself out just on the swing. Like
he's 86
he
years
so
old, though.
Worn out. I mean,
how old is he?
58.
Yeah. Close, 86.
But and I know it was like a last minute thing that he came onto the fight because of Oscar, you know, having to tap out. But it's just so bad, so bad.
Yeah, it's a mixed bag, though, because some people would say, yeah, but it's reinvigorating interest in boxing and maybe it bleeds over into other things and these guys are making a lot of money.
I can see that argument in the case of Jake Paul. Mm-hmm. That is bringing in a new audience.
Don't think that this doesn't have it all to do with him, though. I mean, I think he's...
Yeah, you know, for sure it does. But I'm saying, I could see that argument with someone like Jake Paul, right? That is... Who actually, to his credit, takes it seriously. I mean, that guy looks like a boxer compared to all these dudes. It's so embarrassing, Charlie. It's like you have these guys that...
Well, they're three times his age, though. I mean, come on.
Not just three times his age, but I think it's a combination of that. They're older. They're also people that just don't box at all.
Yeah.
And I don't know. Maybe they're just kind of so much the fact that they're athletes or they have been athletes that they could just show up in a ring and pretend to box. It's just so bad. It's none of it is boxing.
I think they're tapping into part of the initial allure of MMA back in the day. I'm talking about 90s.
Yeah.
When it first got started was this idea that you would see different disciplines battle one another to see who had supremacy.
Right.
Right? So the karate guy with the jiu-jitsu, the shoot fighter with the kung fu, the karate dude with the Greco-Roman wrestling. wrestler. And it was this kind of great, you know, mm-hmm. Avengers-style idea.
Yeah, I've ever seen those, yeah.
Remember? And that kind of went away.
Like the sumo wrestler versus like the kung fu guy.
But think about that. That kind of went away in MMA. Yeah, and MMA got very organized around like, yeah, we're just mixed martial art. That's the whole point. It's right. mixed martial art.
Right.
But it wasn't mixed as in two people from different disciplines. It was you all have you have a little bit of all the disciplines in each fighter.
Yeah.
And interestingly, even though the performance got better, the athletics, all that stuff got better, that kind of like childhood mystique of battling these weird right. things went away. And I think this trailer stuff is bringing some of that back.
I think what it was to what it became is like it went from being like, which is the best fighting discipline that could win out? Like if you have someone that is a kickboxer versus a sumo wrestler, like what wins? Yeah. Which was initially to now like the best athlete that could win. Right?
And the answer, we figured out what wins.
Yeah, but if you're a wrestler, first of all, you're going to win most of the time in MMA.
Right.
People with wrestling backgrounds,
they
dominate.
Do really well. But there's somebody even better, though, than wrestling is jiu-jitsu.
I don't know. I think jiu-jitsu really? Does very well. Yeah, I think people with strong wrestling backgrounds, they dominate in MMA.
Yeah, but look at like all the classic Gracie versus like, what's his face? The guy who was a wrestler. Dan Severin and all those guys. They lost because at the end of the day, they get put in an arm bar or some crazy thing and you know what I mean? It was over. So I think jiu-jitsu mm-hmm. kind of distinguished itself as a uniquely effective fighting discipline through MMA.
Yeah, for sure. Right? Yeah, yeah. It definitely like kind of hit the scene. At least I wasn't as aware of jiu-jitsu. I heard of it, but not to the degree. It was like Hoyce Gracie when I saw that guy dominating people. When he would just throw himself on his back and be like, yep, come at me.
Mm-hmm.
And literally wave people to try to pounce on it, which just seems so counterintuitive. And then he would choke him out, armbar, all kinds of things.
And it was
people didn't know what was happening. When they were trying to fight him.
It was also a little weird and unfair with the gi because he would wear the karate outfit. And then he would grab onto the gi to hold his own arm like in a lock position where normally you'd have to hold your fingers together to try to keep. It was additional leverage.
It was, but it's so counterintuitive.
But
right?
it was because just, it's rope-a-dope. Like, the guy's going to get tired and you're going to choke him out.
I'm just glad in this case, the COO trailer came out and basically we're stepping away from exhibition stuff only. Like they've gotten so much blowback. This fight should have never been sanctioned. Holyfield had no business being in the ring. All of it was just embarrassing.
Triller strikes me as almost, they have like a certain vibe of like the off Vegas strip casino. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's got a little bit of a trashy vibe to it.
It does. Yeah,
like
yeah,
you can expect to see somebody just throwing up in the corner.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so not surprising that this has gone south. But no, I didn't see that. I saw the clip of
it's terrible. And as someone that actually likes boxing, it's embarrassing to watch.
Yeah.
It embarrassed me to watch these guys. It's like it's embarrassing for them, man, because these guys are real athletes.
Yeah,
they're real fighters.
The last thing people are going to remember.
That's right.
But Jesus, what we can do, how we can tie this into what we actually want to talk about? I'm about to watch this. Watch this magic. This magic is none of the people that we've discussed are obese. Correct? So far?
I guess not. No.
None of them are obese.
No, are obese, okay.
And the guy who kicked off the inspiration for our deep dive is the CEO of Sweetgreen, got into some heat by a LinkedIn post connecting COVID deaths to obesity.
That's right.
So there's my parallel connectivity.
What we called in the business a stretch. But anyways, let's get into it because you're right. So the founder and CEO of Sweetgreen, Jonathan Newman, recently set up some controversy, right? Because of this now deleted LinkedIn post, which you mentioned, which you talked about the link between obesity and the deadliness of the pandemic.
Can I just ask right from the get-go, is he doing a LinkedIn post because he doesn't want anybody to see it? Like, is that you know what I mean? Like, you know, we hear about tweets, Facebook post, you know what I'm saying? Like, this may be the first story where it was a LinkedIn post controversy.
Well, yeah, I think but it's interesting because it also speaks to the evolution that LinkedIn has gone through.
It has.
It's so much more
COVID.
Now as a social network.
100%.
Much closer to a Twitter than whatever it ever was before.
And they're encouraging that type of content, too.
And you see the kind of content people are put up. You see the kind of content that you would never see in a kind of work kind of setting. I also think it speaks to, you and I talked about, even the genesis of this podcast, the fact that now in work settings, this whole issue where we say like, if you want to play nice, you don't talk about business or about religion or politics, right? And you kind of keep that off, off the business sort of realm. But the reality, all that stuff is in the mix now. And you see so much of that on LinkedIn. It's as a platform, I think, has evolved significantly. So, yeah, I don't know why he chose LinkedIn necessarily to say this, but in this post, which kind of got him in trouble or at least got, you know, pushback, he basically was saying that no vaccine or mask is going to save us and even proposed taxes on processed food and refined sugar. So basically, in the post, his main point he was making is like, look, we look at the data, 70% of hospitalization are due to COVID are people that are obese and overweight.
Which eight out of 10.
Which really should be or, not, I mean, yeah, it's like it's overweight or obese, right?
Right. So it's 8 out of 10, roughly, of the hospitalizations.
We'll get into that. Give me a look at that number. That number, by the way, does, and I looked at this, it actually comes from a CDC report that was published back in March of this year, right? So that stat is coming out directly from the CDC.
But some of these things, like the government definition of obesity, too, well, or
I
overweight.
I want to talk about that.
I'm 5'8", and I'm 210 pounds. I'm obese. But I'm
for sure.
But I, you know, I can do functional fitness and, you know, pull-ups and stuff and things that maybe some people can't. So, right. But technically, I fall into that category, mm-hmm. And I don't think I am.
I don't think no one thinks they are, Charlie. That's part of the problem. That's the reason. That reason we got here.
Come on, I was waiting for some affirmation.
So part of it is definitely that, which we'll talk about. Now, in this post, he continued: is there an underlying problem that perhaps we have not given attention to? Something that the CDC has pointed to as being one of the factors that can make someone more likely to get severely ill from COVID-19. Right now, he continued, we cannot run away from it and no vaccine nor mask will save us. In full disclosure, I am vaccinated, support others to get vaccinated. What if we made the food that is making us sick illegal? What if we tax processed food and refined sugar to pay for the impact of the pandemic? Right, which is, you know, controversial maybe, but interesting thoughts.
Interesting thoughts. I mean, not the solution and radical in my mind, but still.
Of course, there was immediate pushback, right? Accusing him of basically being fatphobic and being the CEO. And of course, as a CEO.
Which is crazy that that's one of the initial. I mean, I get that that's going to be pushback, but like, why wouldn't the first pushback be like, you know, I find it offensive that you would want to outlaw what people might want to eat? Like, that seems to me like a more fundamental reason to be appalled by something that he may have suggested. Putting aside the fact that he's got interesting questions.
I think that comment squarely lies on where you, like, what your view is of America, I think. If you're in a freedom first and freedom first, second, third, fourth, then you should be like, wait a minute. I don't want you dictating what I can eat or can't eat. If I want to eat burgers all day long and die from it, that's on me.
Yeah, libertarian kind of viewpoint.
Yeah, and it's like people that think that way, right? As a matter of fact, I'm blanking right now. There was one of the shows, it was either a cartoon or something where they basically, oh no, it wasn't a cartoon. It was one of my favorite TV shows from back in the day is Parks and Recreation. You've seen this,
Parks
right?
Parks and Rec, of course.
So one of the things that they did is they put a new legislature to get rid of these like massive drinks that people would have,
I remember,
right?
That
like
episode.
Soda drinks.
Yeah,
and people
don't
were
mess
like
livid
that it was basically like it was bigger than that. It was like a buck. It was like ridiculous, right?
They had to make the point,
but people were so offended that they would put any kind of regulation around like what they could drink, which in essence is kind of liberal. What this guy's saying, right? I mean, not a little bit. It's actually he's saying that directly. And I think the other thing, of course, people are saying, not just the fat shaming, but saying like, hey, but also you happen to be the CEO of this like posh salad place that directly benefits from some of those policies that you're talking about. So that feels extremely self-serving.
Let's outlaw my competitors.
Right.
Which is basically what he was suggesting as a question.
It's an interesting comment, which really got us kind of sort of thinking like, well, what, you know, does he have a point? And what is the impact beyond COVID that we should be talking about, right? So as an example, one thing that I was thinking about one of the questions here is, look, as a country, we have both become much more accepting of different body types, which is good, but have also become way less healthy as people, which is bad, right? So you have this sort of dynamic, more accepting, I like that. But also when you look at, and we'll look at some of the stats right now, I mean, it's gotten out of control in terms of some of the obesity rates. Of course, you got to look at the way that we said obesity is defined. But even putting that to the side,
I think
much more sedentary.
For sure.
Eat terrible for the most part.
I think part of getting to a good place on this discussion is being able to speak clearly and truthfully and openly about some things that are just objectively true.
Yeah.
Obesity is a comorbidity.
Yeah. For sure,
it's morbidity or whatever. It's something that
to a bunch of things, and it's
to a bunch
it's not
of things.
Just it's not just COVID. Like to a bunch
well, of
things.
Well, of course, COVID we're going through right now. But even if you weren't going through COVID, you know, add obesity to whatever, diabetes,
list,
alcoholism.
Yeah, It's high blood pressure, high LDL cholesterol, type 2 diabetes, coronary heart disease, stroke, gallbladder disease. I'm saying that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's gallbladder.
There's all kinds of things. Even mental illness, such as clinical depression and anxiety. These are all things that get impacted by obesity.
What's the obesity rate right now?
So I looked at this report. So according to the 2020 State of Obesity Report, which was published by the CDC. So this is basically looking at 2019 data, okay? But it was published in 2020. It says the U.S. adult obesity rate is 42.4%, which is the first time it's actually over 40%.
It's insane.
Massive. Which has increased by 26% since 2008.
That means that 42.4% of all adults are obese?
Correct.
Wow.
Yeah.
That deserves a moment of silence.
Yeah. So two out of five people are obese. Right? Yeah. Right. Two out of five people. Yeah.
I mean, it's almost half.
A little more.
It's almost half is the way I would think about it.
Yeah. It's almost half. But that's, it's massive. And it's increased once again by 26% since 2008, right? Now, within that, when you break it out by ethnicity, this is also pretty scary, data when you look at this. Diverse people are especially impacted, right? So the highest as a group are black adults at 49.6%, so basically half. And that number is driven by black women at 56.9%, so almost 57%.
So 57% right? of black American women are obese.
Right. I mean, that's a massive, massive number, right? Latino adults are at 44.8%. Once again, in most of these cases, once again, higher than the average, right? And white adults are at 42.2%, so just below the average. And Asian adults are at 17.4%, which is interesting when you think about some of the cultural
nuances, the stereotypes.
Food. Like I was actually listening to a podcast this morning with Joe Rogan, and I forget the name of the chef that he had on the podcast, Asian American chef, and he talks about, I think his background, I want to say it's Chinese. And he was just talking about the way that, family kind of culture kind of eat. A lot of it is like food with rice. It's like, you're going to eat rice and then you're going to have other stuff with rice. So, and when you think about
rice is like the plate.
Right. And when you think about many of the sort of diet guidance and how much is like people talk about being like less carb heavy. And when you think about, population that is very carb heavy, with the rice being literally like a staple of every meal, it's interesting that they're so low. It's everything else, of course, right? And other dynamics. But it is interesting that they're so low from an obesity standpoint.
There's a number of interesting cultural things about that, though. I mean, outside of China, I think of Japan, Vietnam, other Asian countries, there's a propensity to eat with the food. There's this bowl dynamic where you're holding the food in a bowl in your hand and eating from that rather than eating from a table. And there's something about like taking, more measured bites from a portion you're holding in your hand that I think ties into some of this. Because look, you can also make the case scientifically, carbohydrate rich or heavy diet is also not good for you, right?
Right. That's
there's kind of, definitely benefits making, of keto and all that stuff.
Yeah.
So you can't go like, the Asians are a lot less obese and they eat rice, so therefore we should all eat rice.
Right, I think
there's a number of cultural things that make that experience different for them.
Don't you think even the dynamic of eating with chopsticks?
Of course, it's more measured bites.
Slows you down just a little bit more,
of course it does.
Right?
No, that's actually a very serious thing because if you're eating smaller bites, that means that your system is, processing this stuff, right? In a different way, and you get full. You can take these little like chopsticks and put 10 or 15 of them, and by the time you're done, you're full, right? As opposed to, let me have this steak in front of me with a fork and a knife, cut one giant thing. My first bite is 40% of my stomach's capacity, right? And you feel like you have to finish it. So you end up overeating. No, this is very true.
No, that is true. So portion size significant. You see this when you travel anywhere outside of the U.S. Portion size here is just so much larger than anywhere else.
The more interesting thing to me, and perhaps more controversial, is we keep seeing white and Asian as, let's say, paired in a lot of these multicultural data that we look at, Asians paired with whites in opposition to, in most cases, Latinos and blacks, right? So here, again, whites and Asians have an underindex of obesity. The whites, not as much.
Yeah, they're Asians, in the same group, unfortunately. I think Asian is almost like the outlier here. I mean, they're so much lower
Asian's
than everybody
the
else.
Outlier, right.
They're at 17% versus everyone else is in the 40s.
Correct. Right? But what I'm saying is, again, just the thematically, though, generally speaking, maybe there's is there a whatever class
There is definitely class, education.
Education.
There's all these that all play a factor, right? By the way, the, to me, one of the saddest things looking at this data is actually for children, right? So for children aged 2 to 19, they are 19.3% obese, right? This is up from 5.5% from the mid-70s.
So it's almost a 4X. How sad is that? That's almost a 4X, dude.
How crazy is that? That's in one generation.
That's nuts. A 400% increase in one generation.
One generation, think about that.
Well, how can you not directly correlate this to the fact that in the 70s, kids were outside?
This is outside. There's the food as well. Kind of all of these things, right? The amount of activity, technology, playing a factor, to your point, playing a factor of people just being much more sedentary, like all of that. You know, we talk about this all the time, right? When growing up as a kid, the argument with your parents is like, come back inside and do your homework or come in to eat or whatever. Now it's like get out of your room. Yeah, get out of your room. Go outside. Do something.
Yeah.
Like get off the computer. Get off your phone. Now, in general, right, the more a person earns, the less likely they are to have obesity, right? That's a little bit what we're talking about. Individuals with less education are also more likely to have obesity, right? Rural communities have higher rates of obesity and severe obesity than do suburban and metro areas.
Yeah.
I also think, too, when it comes to some of those breakdown by ethnicity, a lot has to do with where people live. We've talked about this dynamic of people living in food deserts where the only options are these fast food options that are more – that are more economically viable, but they're also significantly worse for, you know, in terms of like for your body, et cetera, too. I should be, you know, be eating these
things. And for those people who might think, well, why don't you just go to the supermarket in the food deserts? Even those supermarkets, there are bargain basement brand of supermarkets that have been created for these food desert environments. When you walk into them, you know, like Food Lion and all these different, there's just crappy food there, even if it's a supermarket.
Yeah, there is. So it did prompt the question because I was kind of because I was looking at this. I'm like, well, what is actually considered? By the way, Nashi, one of the questions I had is like, especially going back to the first point about the connection between obesity and being overweight, right? That 78% with hospitalizations due to COVID, right? So that's a pretty really high number, right? High correlation between those two numbers. But when we look at the actual percentage of Americans that are considered either obese or overweight, right? Because we talked about the 40% being just for obesity, or that 42% being just for obesity. When you look at obese or overweight, for adults age 20 and over, it's actually 71.6%. So that, when I hear that, it actually takes away, in my mind, quite a bit from looking at the data and saying that there is a really high direct cause and effect between obesity or being overweight, let's just say, right? And COVID hospitalization when the entire population is just that high to begin with. It's more effective than just what the entire population already is. Mm-hmm. There's almost like a 72% of adults being considered overweight, including obesity, right? Which is all based on, basically looking at people's BMI, right? Body mass index. So in terms of definitions, right? Overweight is defined as a BMI between 25 and 29.9.
Percent of your body that's made up of fat.
Correct.
Right.
And then a BMI of 30 or higher is considered obese, right?
Okay.
So I checked it on myself
uh-huh.
to see what it was. Now, this is not like a true BMI test that you would do like at a gym or whatever, some of mm-hmm. do these things. This is simply just putting your weight, height, et cetera. So at 168 pounds, so I fluctuate. I'm usually in a good day, 165 to all the way to 170, kind of go between those two, right? At 168 pounds, my BMI is 24.8, which would be considered normal. Right? At 169 pounds, my BMI is 25, which is not considered overweight.
You're considered overweight.
At 169. Right now, I'm 169. So basically, I'll be in the overweight category.
So there has to be some discounting then of these percentages.
I think a little bit, right? Because I could be accused of a lot. I think that's probably not one that I will get a lot.
But look, one of the things that came up to me when we decided to talk about this, because it's definitely, you know, a topic you and I have discussed, right? What is lacking in our communication around COVID, around how people should be increasing their level of overall health as a way to avoid either, you know, a stronger COVID negative reaction or avoid it in general? Like, what contribution does that thought have to all of this? Mm-hmm. Because what everybody is concerned about is vaccine, no vaccine, mask, no mask. That's what seems to, dominated the overall conversation. And there's more to discuss than that. But one thing I thought about where I do agree with this guy, even though there's a lot of stuff that I actually take issue with, but one thing that I do think about is I just got back from Ohio, as you know. I was visiting my father-in-law who's in the hospital. He just had double lung transplant surgery. Okay. This dude's been in the ICU for like a month recovering from this, right? You got to put in like this huge robe from head to toe. You got to wear gloves, face, like everything you can imagine just to visit the guy. And there's 1,000 machines and pipes and tubes and all stuff. And he's getting the best care in the world and amazing, all good. I'm sitting there visiting and the dude comes with the food, right? Mm-hmm. Which he's not even eating solid food. Like he was actually transitioning from the feeding tube to eating solid food.
Right.
And what do you have in the tray? You ready for this?
All right.
Vanilla ice cream, just regular like red, you know, red cap milk, right? Like rice, some piece of meat with like a bunch of gravy on top of it, butter, a bunch of different stuff. And I'm thinking to myself, you know, the amount of time, energy, expertise, all this stuff, this amazing precision to put another human being's lungs inside of you and make them work, right? And we're basically bringing up a tray of food I could have bought at a gas station.
Right.
Like, and you're putting that in you, and yeah, there's no thought to this, Jesus. There's no thought.
This is in a hospital.
In a hospital, right?
Yeah, that is the sad reality we're in. Look, we can because even when we think about the BDMI thing, BMI, the body mass index.
Yeah,
we can debate at the edges what it may be, should be.
So discard the edges, right? Then. Just forget the edges.
But when you look at the broader trend of obesity rates and how that's just continues to go up. And especially when you think about for kids, like going right to that point, right? 5% to now 20, 19, basically. Like almost 20. Like that is crazy. I mean, we are definitely going in the wrong direction. And unfortunately, I think we're in a situation where there is such even stigma to some degree of having the real conversation with people that, hey, you like also have to take care of yourself a little bit better. Like I was telling the story and I don't want to like call out the person that told me this, but it's a friend of ours who was telling me this. And, you know, she was describing this situation where she went to a doctor in TJ and was doing like a checkup, et cetera. And
that's
the doctor.
Tijuana for all our white listeners.
Yeah, Tijuana. And the doctor was like older guy. It was just brutal with her. But like, hey, you got to lose weight. You got to lose weight like right now. And this is how much you're over. And like, there was no hesitation, no thought about, am I going to hurt your feelings by saying this? It was like, you at your age and the way that you have, like, that is not okay. You need to drop weight. You want to be healthy? You want to live? Like, you got to live longer? And this is someone that, yeah, it's, you know, it's overweight and someone that recognizes and probably want to do something about it. But to have that kind of honest, brutal conversation with people, and I know it's not the popular thing to say, but there's also something to, you know, to be given to that. The other thing I will tell you is like my daughter does gymnastics, right? And it kind of reminds me how easy it is to just get offended and the reaction be to protect you, you know, individuals, yourself, et cetera, rather than actually listen to like, is there truth to what this person is saying? When these kids all started coming back from being all at home because of COVID, right? In the last year, one of the comments that she made to me and my daughter's mom is like, hey, like, you know, I think some of the kids have gained weight. We got to like get them back in shape. And these are all kids that you look at them and no will have a reaction that says, any of these kids are, they're all like super lean, right? But in her mind, this is like it's also a cultural thing, right? She's Russian. Like there is like I'm going to tell you exactly what I'm thinking without thinking like, am I hurting your feelings? Because she's like, I want these kids to compete. They need to be better. And she was like brutally just going. And we're looking at each other like, what are you talking about? Like, what? Like, are you talking about our daughter? Are you talking about like someone else's kid? Look at her like, our kid looks like pretty athletic here, but at the same time, you listen to him like, maybe there is some truth to that. And that's a little bit of an extreme case, but we don't have any of that, I think, for the most part. And I think that's having a direct impact on the overall health of individuals, of people. And it has a major impact on healthcare costs, on these kinds of, I mean, including COVID. There's definitely a correlation here, right? That we're just much unhealthier as a society because of this.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. By the way, I can imagine the trainer lady, whatever it was, the kids, they are too heavy. Yeah, exactly. They must be leaner.
Yeah,
we must get them to run very hard.
Yeah, and you know, I hurt my feelings a little bit. I wanted to like immediately respond to him, like
no,
I'm gonna hold that. Just you know,
Yeah, I think
that's like the natural reaction though for most of us,
for
right?
Sure.
Whether for our kids, whether it's for ourselves, but like no one wants to have that conversation.
The other, well, here's the other thing that really helped me understand it, and you know, I think we can dissect this particular person's comments, but the point of bringing into the discussion what role we have to play with our own health, I think, is an important one. Here's one thing that always helped me. We obsess, or a lot of people do obsess, if you have an internal combustion engine car, which increasingly less of out there with all the electric stuff that's going on. But you used to obsess with like what kind of octane gas to put in your car. There was like octane boosters. There's the kind of oil, this kind of weight, all these different things, these very fine-tuned things. And people who are into that like spend time and money and energy on these things. And that's what you put into a car dramatically impacts its performance. Mm-hmm. There's no question about it. And now you imagine a significantly more complex engine, which is the human body. And the amount of time, again, this hospital example is mind-blowing, but the amount of time that we think about what happens to stuff we put in our bodies and what it does is so small relative to the amount of time we might think of other things, right? Again, the car example or, you know, there's a number of them. But my point is that we are significantly more complex in a car. And we don't oftentimes spend a lot of time thinking about the kind of stuff we put in us. And we kind of come to the end of the road and have these different issues. And we want to look around in some cases for quick fixes or other things. And I don't blame anybody for doing that. But the reality of it is that you got to start almost at a foundational level, right? Mm-hmm. And take a hard look at the lifestyle. Because if you have a 9-year-old who 40 years ago was 5% obese and now is 20% obese, I don't know that there's a quick fix to that. That's a ground up restructuring of how that person is actually living to make an impact there. You see what I'm saying? Yeah. Like I think like we've got so good at focusing around a number of things, but we're not really paying as much attention as we should to this, which I think is really fundamental and it contributes dramatically to how we live our lives and how we're going to be impacted, yes, by COVID, even if it's unpopular to say, has a big role to play in that. Doesn't mean you won't get sick. Doesn't mean you can't die.
Right.
But it's like, to me, it's almost the corollary of like the vaccine will, yeah, you can still get it, but you're going to fare a lot better, right? Same thing with health. You can get it, but you're going to be a lot better off. And I don't know what's controversial about that, or at least it shouldn't be.
How do you reconcile, Charlie, what feels like an all-time high in terms of awareness around wellness, being a focus for a lot of people, being a lot of conversation? You have so many different like companies that are specifically built around wellness. I've never seen as much focus on wellness as we have now. Some of them on mental health, of course, but also like physical wellness, et cetera. And yet this dynamic taking place.
I think because most of that wellness is being communicated through things that keep you immobile. I think a lot of that wellness is still communicated, or wellness tactics and strategies communicated through screens and communicated through immobility, right? So I think that's part of it. I think also that we're very focused on self right now. Our culture is very focused on itself, myself, my well-being, mm-hmm. what I'm doing. There's this kind of like feedback loop that we're creating amongst ourselves. And that means we're oriented inwardly and not outwardly. If we're oriented outwardly, I think that there's health benefits. If we're only oriented inwardly, I think that you get situations like this. So I would say those two things.
I also think there is an orientation to comfortable wellness, things that are easier to do that makes us feel better about ourselves. Hey, yeah. I'm going to do a detox. I'm going to drink this. I'm going to eat that. Just something that is good. It's good. And that's great. That's fine. But part of the sad reality, or maybe the reality of some situation, is some of it just requires work.
Of course it
does. To actually like get
it
yourself
hurts.
Back. And it hurts. And it's painful. It's a pain in the ass. You don't want to do it. Like,
but that's a very important principle.
That's a tough thing, yeah.
It's a very important principle, and it has ramifications and implications well beyond health. I mean, it's got, you know, mental wellness, spirituality, all these things. Is that, you know, sometimes you have to go through something difficult, suffering, in order to get to, you know, break down before you break through, right? And we don't want to break down. We just want to break through constantly. And that's that can be a situation where you're just, you know, being self-referential all day. And frankly, the evidence or the data here supports that, unfortunately, is happening. So.
Yeah, I think one of the missed opportunities that we've definitely have had in this moment is that this hasn't been enough of the conversation.
Yeah.
There hasn't been enough things being put in place for longer term healthiness of people in general, and really pumping up that education, especially during a time where it's really important, where it can make a difference. Right now, I don't think it should supplement or replace the immediate, right? Which is like, hey, make sure you're taking care of yourself, you're getting vaccinated, you're doing whatever you need so you don't get sick. But if you're neglecting the second part, which is like, it's also like start working, uses the moment of inflection to have healthier lives to begin with. And someone starts with putting in that, you know, the kind of work. That
it's a great opportunity for reset. You know, that's actually the theme, just last point, going back to my father-in-law, is like, look, he had a difficult health journey. Now he's had this incredible, you know, traumatic surgery, but he's got a great opportunity to hit the reset button and start fresh doing different things. I think we all have that opportunity, right? Mm-hmm. Coming out of COVID, doing also hit the reset button and do some of the things differently. And we have been, right? We've been doing a lot of new things, but take this as a moment to basically start afresh and try to reverse some of this stuff. I mean, we kind of need these big moments of inflection in order to change big trends. Otherwise, they don't change. So I think this is an opportunity that's within all this stuff.
Agree.
Cool.
So,
should we move on?
Let's move on.
Courage or cringe?
Courage or cringe?
Boom. Okay.
Did the sound effect already happen, or is it?
It I don't know.
I was going to react to it, but I'm not sure if it happened.
I think you should react. React now.
Oh, I love that. Love that.
It's the magic of audio.
Courage or cringe? The FEC, or the Federal Election Commission, dismisses claim that Twitter illegally blocked a Hunter Biden article. So,
what? Okay. Uh-huh. I know there's a lot here. We need, and we're gonna punch through these. But what weight does their dismissal or their approval have on anything? In other words, what is the if the Federal Election Commission says you're right, your complaint is valid? What does that mean? There's no money. Like, what happens here? What's the, do you know? Like,
that's,
I could see the
great question.
The FCC, I can see. The FTC, I can see, because they can affect the way you trade or communicate
or something. Yeah, there has to be repercussion by them saying that it was a violation. Because that's basically their role, is to make sure that elections are done fairly, that basically they regulate how elections are done. I mean, we know this even from an advertising standpoint, right? In terms of the amount of rates you have to make available for any kind of candidate. There's rules specific around elections. So, yeah, it's a great question. I don't know what the ramification would be if found guilty. But yeah, so last fall, right at the height of the presidential race, Twitter decided to block users from posting links to a New York Post article about Joe Biden's son, Hunter Biden.
It's a famous laptop.
Right. That's right. The piece alleged that Mr. Biden, or, you know, the President Biden, had met with an advisor to a Ukraine energy company on whose board Hunter Biden served. Right. And this was all sort of captured from this famous laptop that had been left at this laptop repair place. Right. And that was kind of the story. Right. Now, there was something that was, of course, denied by the Biden campaign based on his official calendar. That's basically what they said, like, right? And this, and the whole thing is still very gray in terms of how much truth there is in there. My POV is probably more truth than not in that situation. But this pushback by Twitter and other social media platforms immediately resulted in an outcry from conservatives, right? Claiming that big tech was once again aiding the election of Biden, right? Or being anti-conservative. Which led to the Republican National Committee filing a formal complaint with the Federal Election Commission, the FEC, accusing Twitter of using its corporate resources to benefit the Biden campaign. Well, the FEC now, very recently, came back and actually dismissed those allegations. Now they said they determined that Twitter's action regarding the Hunter Biden article had been undertaken for a valid commercial reason, not a political purpose, and was thus allowable, right?
What was the valid commercial reason?
They said that there's two cases, right? That was one, and I'll give you the reason they said. The second case involved Snapchat. And the commission used basically the same reasoning to reject the complaint from the Trump campaign. The Trump campaign argued that the company provided an improper gift to Mr. Biden by rejecting Mr. Trump from his Discover platform in the summer of 2020, according to another commission document.
Right? Both of these cases, though, have the first problem with them is that they're making a little bit of a Hail Mary proposition. The first part is they're claiming these platforms almost made an in-kind contribution to the campaigns by virtue of the actions they took. An in-kind contribution would be you giving airtime. you giving a some platform or forum that otherwise wouldn't exist to the other party. Because to your point, the way that that these things are managed is if you give the Republicans X, you have to give the Democrats X. If you give them Republicans Y, you have to give – it's very right. fairly done. So the first swag is – it's a pretty high bar to say these guys are giving an in-kind contribution. I understand the point philosophically, but from a legal perspective, I can see why that's a hard hurdle to overcome, right?
It is, right? And especially because of the reason why they didn't make the, like, especially like for Twitter, right? So, like, the Federal Election Commission said in both cases that the companies had acted in their own commercial interest, according to the factual and legal analysis provided by to the parties involved. The commission also said that for Twitter, they had followed existing policy related to hacked materials because that was the reason
that they gave.
And basically, they said, like, listen, they're following the policy that they have in place for hacked materials,
right,
so they won't make it available. And therefore, based on that same policy, they didn't do something special for this, which is why I think at the end of the day, to your point, yeah. that's the argument. Like, even if it would have benefited Biden,
sure.
it doesn't matter because they follow their own protocol for how they handle this kind of
government. Their own protocol with a layer of interpretation, because nothing about the story suggested anything was hacked, right? So in other words, they read someone's come in contact with a laptop, right, that was left there, never picked up, became the property of the person who was repairing it then, because they had their own policy. If you don't come back and get your stuff, it becomes mine after a certain amount of time. Then they had that laptop and they were making its contents available or the laptop available. They said that that was part of their hack policy. Well, my point is there's some interpretation even in that.
For sure, it's interpretation of what you consider hacked, right? If you consider hacked to be access to content that you shouldn't have access to is one thing versus simply saying like this thing was left here long enough. And the whole thing is like left here long enough that now it's mine. And therefore everything associated with this or access to any content that resides in the web –
right. If it's in a cloud somewhere, it's now mine just because I have the hardware. Yeah. I understand that.
There's a tricky one here. A gray area at minimum, right?
Yeah, for sure.
And all of this, of course, just added more fuel to the fire that conservatives feel that big tech is anti-conservative, right? So courage or cringe, FEC protecting private businesses to enact their content policies or further bolstering of liberal tech to influence political outcomes.
Yeah.
Charlie.
So FEC, I actually looked it up. It's bipartisan. The commissioners, there's six of them. They're elected or assigned by the president, the sitting president. There are currently three Republicans, two Democrats, and one independent on the commission. So it is bipartisan. Those are the people who actually make these rules. I still don't
know. And the people that made this, I guess now some people that made the call still would have been assigned by President Trump. Is that correct?
I don't know that.
Yeah, I don't know that. All switched out when the administration comes in. Right?
They're on their way, right? So either if they haven't been switched out, they will be. But I don't know. My point is that it's bipartisan. I still don't understand what power these people have. If the Republicans had been successful, what would that have meant? Right. Now that the case has been dismissed, what does that mean? I don't understand that. It looks a little rubber stampy to me. Look, at the end of this, I think there's three parts to this. I net out on cringe. But here, the three parts that I took into consideration, one is, like I said, a bit of a Hail Mary because you have to actually try to show that that these companies, Twitter and Snapchat specifically, took an actual material action purposely in order to give an unfair advantage to one of the candidates. It's just kind of a high bar, right? Yeah. It's a high bar to hit. But I understand philosophically.
And it's a stretch to argue that too.
It's a stretch to argue it, but so that's like your opening salvo in this. It's going to be difficult, right? The FEC ruling also dismissed another thing, claims that Twitter was breaching election laws by shadow banning Republican users or appearing to decrease the visibility of their posts, right? Mm-hmm. They dismissed that outright. Here, I mean, and again, we'd have to look at all these different proceedings, but I know that this stuff happens. Like, I know because it's happened, and I've showed you some of these examples happened to me. My friend just, and I don't know what you would call shadow banning, but my friend, Lila Rose, shout out to Lila, runs an organization called Live Action. They're a pro-life organization, right? Mm-hmm. They basically produce videos that show that, like all, like we talked about on the last show, every, you know, scientist and every embryologist would agree that a new life is created at conception. At fertilization is what you'd call it scientifically, not conception. Mm-hmm. Same thing, though. Anyway, so she's spending $40,000, $45,000 a month on Google, and she just got completely deplatformed, can't spend any money because she was promoting this video that actually showed biologically what happens inside of a woman, right? So And the reason that Google gave was that she was making unreliable claims.
Okay.
That's the reason that they mm-hmm. gave, right? And I can tell you everything that is in that video, Jesus, is literally from an embryology textbook, right?
Okay.
But because it's this organization doing it, that kind of stuff happens a lot. And I hear about it from a lot of people in my network. So I don't know whether you call that shadow banning or throttling or suppression or whatever mm-hmm. it is, but how do we address those things that do happen? And just saying, oh, well, you know, we dismiss that doesn't really get at the heart of some of these things that actually are happening. And I think that that's a lost opportunity, right? Anyway, look, for me, I guess I come down on cringe. And it's not – I'm not putting this together very well, but I come down –
I mean, you're making too
– too many points.
Yeah, and also very different points.
Well, I'm making a point about the thing that they dismiss the idea of throttling and shadow banning, and like
right.
that doesn't happen in this case. Maybe it didn't in this case, but it does happen. Is my point? That's what I'm making.
Right.
Because I've seen it happen in my own life.
Yeah, no, I hear you on that. I think the other thing too. I was trying to find out why you were saying this, but the thing where not that I'm not arguing it doesn't happen, but where that narrative starts to fall apart a little bit is when you look at the most active social accounts. I think Facebook specifically, they seem to be like really conservative. Those are the ones that get the highest engagement, that are people are much more active on the platform, which means that they're getting a lot more visibility on it. That doesn't mean that, to your point, that some of those get banned anyway. And in spite of that, it still generates because maybe they're more controversial, et cetera. But that's what, and I know you and I have talked about it in this podcast, and I don't have it in front of me, so I won't pull it up. But that's mm-hmm. that is something that has been reported on, which is it goes counter to, maybe it goes directly in line, like two things can be true. They could both be the most yeah. actively engaged, social shared, et cetera, and still be, to your point, shadow ban, whatever you want to call it.
I think
guess both things could be true.
We talked about how both things can be true also on a recent show with Facebook, both promoting and supporting
right.
religious-based things, and then on the other side, the religious people feeling like they're being throttled and shadow banned, right? So you can maybe play both sides of the equation. In the comment that you just made, too, mm-hmm. and I know it's not a one-to-one, but I do hear a little bit of something we've heard in our business career, like, oh, Latinos are 30% of the box office, and we're not even advertising to them. Why would we? They're already there. Do you see what I'm saying? Like, it's it's like, oh, the conservatives have a lot of engagement, so there can't be anything wrong with their engagement. Like, it doesn't necessarily follow. But
it doesn't necessarily follow.
But look,
I agree with that.
My point is on this, for no good reason, maybe that I just don't like federal bureaucracies, I'm a cringe on this because I don't think it's just as easy to say, hey, nothing to see here. There was no advantage.
Look that way.
Look that way. There was no advantage given at all to the Biden campaign by this pretty big story being basically taken off the service. And then Twitter, for one, Dorsey admitting he shouldn't have done that. But days after the fact where, frankly, some of the damage was done, right? If you thought it was beneficial, you'd think you'd view it as damage.
Sure.
So like to just go, oh, dismissed. Like it just doesn't capture, to my mind, the impact of this thing.
That. I think when I look at this, frankly, I think your argument may be more lean even harder towards saying why it's courage. Because I think I agree with you. I think the point that was being, the reason why this began to be, they started to begin with, which is the Republican National Committee filed this formal complaint saying that Twitter was using its corporate resources to benefit the Biden campaign. That is just hard to prove in this case. Not looking at anything else, just simply that statement, like what kicked off the start.
Yeah, I agree with that.
There's a Snapchat thing as well, but even that one is hard to argue that they're doing this specifically to benefit the Biden campaign. So for that, I mean, not taking anything for granted what you said, I think that is probably the simplest way of looking at this specific issue and saying why I end up being courage. Because I think that it didn't reach that kind of threshold being approved that this directly was to benefit Biden. And at least it sounds like, at least the reason why they claim to not have wanted to promote this, at least sounds like it was consistent to their policy to begin with, right? So it wasn't like a special exception. Although we are going to talk about that in the third topic about special exceptions. So I'm excited about talking about
that. All right, let's go to number two.
So topic number two, courage or cringe, Pinterest accused of not paying female co-creator. So as reported by the New York Times, this past Monday, Christine Martinez sued Pinterest. In her suit, she accused Ben Silberman and Paul Ciara, two of Pinterest's three co-founders, of breach of implied contract, idea theft, unjust enrichment, and unfair business practices. Now, she's alleging that she co-created Pinterest alongside with the plaintiffs by contributing ideas that were core organizing concepts, such as organizing images on boards and enabling e-commerce. Now, she was never formally employed by Pinterest, nor did she ask for a contract. She was not given stock, though she said Pinterest founders had verbally agreed to compensate her many times. She claims to have an implied contract and was also just part of it. She was also like really close friends with the two co-founders, right? Now, to the matter, she said, I always expected that when they could compensate me, they would, adding that she had been naive and that there was never a doubt in my mind, right? She added to that, they had no marketing background or expertise in creating a product for women. My role was to always educate them. Now, according to Ms. Martinez, she helped the founders in a wide range of concepts, from its name and features to its marketing strategy and product roadmap. Now, she herself had launched an e-commerce startup called Llama Designs that has showed promise but apparently struggled to raise money, right? But Pinterest was basically an idea, and credentials from the founders got funded, so she was happy to help out her friends.
Kind of stuff happens all the time.
All the time, right? Now, to this, Pinterest responded via spokeswoman that Ms. Martinez's allegations were without merit.
Without
the
merit.
Company with the defendant's
position. Baseless accusations.
In court. Now, this incident was interesting. Once again, puts in question whether Pinterest, which caters primarily to female users, is hostile to women and minorities in its workplace. Now, last summer, and I'm going to mess up this name, so I apologize.
Just say person A, person B.
Person A. last name was Zoma. And
nice.
Erica, Soma, yeah. Erica Banks, two former Pinterest employees, wrote on Twitter about the pay disparities, retaliation, and sexist, racist comments they had experienced at the company. Shortly after, Francois Brouwer, Pinterest's former chief operating officer, sued the company, claiming gender discrimination and retaliation. Now, the latter resulted in a settlement of $22.5 million for Ms. Brouwer.
Wow.
Which included a $2.5 million donation towards charities for women and underrepresented minorities in tech. Right? So this is...
Wish we would have known about that.
Yeah, exactly. So courage or cringe, opportunist looking to cash in on a successful unicorn startup, or ungrateful founders not doing the right thing for those that helped them get there.
I had to do some digging on this one to find out, why are you bringing the suit now? Right. In other words, what's the moment that you're bringing? Because
she said she didn't realize she wasn't going to get compensated until after Pinterest went public in 2019. Now, between 2019 and now,
it's almost 2022. Is my point. So that was years ago, and I know that legal proceedings take a long time. I found an answer to that potentially.
Oh,
and
what was the answer?
The answer was that there was a death in her family, and the death in her family gave her the kind of emotional.
Oh, I did see that. Whatever,
the courage or desire or impetus to actually go forward with this lawsuit. And she filed it, and she just doesn't want to, in her words, go to the grave knowing that this actually happened. It's a really interesting thing because, look, we've been around very early stage companies. We've done our own share of early stage company startups. And there's a lot of conversations that you have in the very beginning with a lot of people who oftentimes give you free advice, like all the time. You know, it's like, oh, you should consider this. A lot of those things are good ideas and you incorporate them. But so one part about this that's dangerous is, does that mean everyone who's given you advice just because you asked for it and they offered it now can make a claim over how that advice helped you to create a product? Like, that's a real question because that happens all the time. Now, there's a difference in reasonableness about just advice you get on a call or in a conference or somebody you just bump into is like, hey, you should do it in blue, not in red. Like, there's that. And then there's somebody who has a material, daily, consistent, repeatable influence on your company for a sustained period of time. My reading of this evidence is that this woman was in the latter category.
Yeah, okay.
She was in the category of somebody who was around pretty consistently, used as a platform to get advice from pretty consistently, represented the company in the public sphere pretty consistently, in fact, did an appearance on Good Morning America to like promote the company back in whenever it was. All of those things, and the fact that she had a very close association with the founders, went to the guy's wedding, was a bridesmaid. I mean, all these different things makes me feel that it was somebody who was in a much closer orbit than your typical just kind of guy who gives you the random advice because you asked, right?
Yeah.
For all those reasons, I'm on courage, and I think that it's an interesting case. I think that it's, again, I'm making some assumptions. If I'm right about all this stuff, what I said, then I think it's good. If I'm wrong and she gets a big paycheck, I think that that could open up a Pandora's box potentially. But as I read this evidence, I'm courage on her bringing that case.
Yeah, I'm with you. I think their closeness. Look, also from an optics standpoint, it just looks terrible right now for Pinterest. They've had a situation last summer. They paid out almost $23 million to their ex-COO. Like, those are not good signs. And you have a situation here where I think the other dynamic, too, that you can't, you know, shy away from is the fact is you have three guy co-founders who build a brand that is, like,
100% women.
100% women. Like, its full DNA is 100% women. So part of her argument is, like, how do you think that happened? Like, how do you think they were able to get this so right? And her, with her background in design and all the basically things that she's talking to directly, I think she probably makes a pretty good case how she probably played a pretty outsized influence being so close to them, to your point, and bringing that perspective. Now, it also, this is a great use case as to how, even in the case where there is lots of, I literally was having this conversation yesterday with someone, but not exact situation, but early stage startup, friends that were helping each other out, all of a sudden capital gets raised and there is now an issue where, like, founders not wanted to pay the person that did a lot to help them because it was like a little bit of handshake implied. Like, that's a sort of uncomfortable conversation that people are sometimes don't want to have because there's friendships that are involved here. But it's also the reality that if you don't do that, then you're in these kind of situations, you know. So I'm much more believing her case than what she's saying here. Even if it's a little bit embellished in terms of how much it played, you know, role she played. And I think also these guys, the founders of Pinterest, in a situation where they have a bad track record. And this is not a good narrative of what just happened. And then now having this person kind of come out this way, I think they're going to have to pay up in all scenarios. I think this thing is settled in all scenarios.
The other part that's suspect is in their response, they don't characterize what she did do. In other words, I found that very interesting. They could have easily said, Miss Martinez was part of a large group of people who occasionally gave input and like they could have said that, but they're like basically without merit. They don't address any of the stuff that she says.
Yeah.
And that to me feels like they're already playing little 3D chess, which brings credibility
to
her case.
It's not going to end well. I just think it's not a matter of whether or not.
Well, for her. Though. Yeah, she'll be
it's
all
not
right.
A matter of whether or not she's getting money. It's like how much.
How much is she going to get?
Yeah, yeah.
And what does that mean? Yeah. For her going forward. Yeah. Agreed. Cool.
All right. Last. So we're in agreement on that second one. All right. Last Courage or Cringe, Facebook. Did you know, by the way, this is a show about social platforms. Did you notice that?
Apparently.
All three, Courage or Cringe, are all social platforms. So Facebook quietly lets 5.8 million politicians and celebrities get special enforcement of its rules.
That's not going to raise any concern, Jesus. That's not going to ruffle any feathers. Why would it?
So according to a piece by the Wall Street Journal, Facebook has an internal system that exempts 5.8 million users from having to follow the rules on its platform. Now, this is actually not a new issue. As soon as I read this, I'm like, of course, that
is
true.
We talked about this on a previous show.
Because this dynamic was actually proven out very clearly last year by copycat accounts of President Trump. Do you remember this? That they basically were posting the exact same thing that he will post to see how long it will take for them to get flagged while the president's page remained active. On Facebook, there was the Will They Suspend Me Facebook page. And on Twitter, there was one called Suspend the Press. Now, but these are people that were specifically trying to make the case that the president
there were different
should
rules.
There were different rules and he should get suspended, and showing in real life how the exact same message will get their accounts flagged and suspended, and then his
but
wasn't.
None of those people had done the research on what we did for the previous show that actually showed that Facebook has a different policy, right? They've said that people who are public figures, and they define it in a way that's really weird. I forget exactly how we discussed it, but that there is reason for the public to be aware of what they're saying simply because of their position.
Their argument, correct. But in those cases, if you recall, it was both, I think, on Facebook and Twitter, where they would put warnings for people before they look at the content, right? And the argument was like, we're not gonna completely take it off because being that it's a president, we feel that content needs to be shown, but we're going to put a label saying that the information on this content may be suspects.
This is different things, though.
And that was one that they would do. What they're arguing here is cases where there was like direct violations to the content policy, of where their accounts were not at all being impacted, and theirs is a personal account with the exact same text, everything copied exactly the same, immediately flagged. And it means, you know, taken down.
There's gradations of this. So my point is that at a baseline, there are, admitted by Facebook, different rules for public figures, especially those that have, however they define it, I forget how they said it, but basically politicians, okay? their baseline, there's different rules. Now, to your point, what you said, they also went an additional step and said, in those cases where President Trump is saying something that is not true or whatever, we're going to put this disclaimer on top of that now. That's an additional rule.
It kept on escalating. Remember this, right? It kept on escalating. Initially, they were just ignoring it.
Correct. But the baseline rule.
Yeah, that's right, because they're politicians, so we got to treat them a little bit different.
Right.
Then they were like, okay, they're not getting really carried away. So let's put a little disclaimer that says, hey, what's here, you really have to like keep in mind that some of this information may not be accurate. And then they finally took the step of actually starting to actually flag content, which was, I think Twitter was the very first one that did it, right?
Yeah. And then it got to the point of even really craziness where anything, if you mentioned Trump, you were getting a warning on your post.
Right. Like, then it applied to everything.
Literally like, everything is like, the sky is blue. Warning.
I would argue that there's functionality on my Instagram that I can no longer use. Because we mentioned COVID so much on our post from the content. As a matter of fact, funny enough, yesterday I put a picture of me working on the notes for today's show. And I just simply say something like working on the whatever for the next episode. And I get a flag in my post about COVID because in the picture you can see that there was in the story about Sweetgreen, there was the word COVID shows up on the picture. And therefore my Instagram post got flagged. And I could see it on my Instagram story got flagged that basically for research around COVID, click here. I was like, oh, wow. I didn't even say anything. Dude. It was like, it was a picture where like COVID shows up on.
So how does that make you feel? Like, what do you think?
It happens to me all the time. Like every other post like happened all the time. All the time.
Uh-huh. And how does that make you feel?
Yeah. I mean, I don't love that idea.
Yeah, I don't either.
I don't love that idea for sure. But anyway, so this was happening, right? So the investigation detailed basically how high-profile users on its service who are newsworthy, influential, or popular.
That's what it was, newsworthy.
Or PR risky, see the same enforcement action as do ordinary users, citing company documents it had viewed, right? So this included figures like former President Trump, of course, soccer star Neymar, Neymar da Silva Santos, right?
Yeah.
And then Senator Elizabeth Warren, and even Doug the Pug. Are covered by the system. I don't know who Doug the Pug is. Do you know the name?
I think, isn't it that British dog that's like a comedian? It's like it's something like that.
The system is nicknamed X-Check or Cross-Check, right? The problem is that once added to this group, it makes their account much harder to moderate, right? As an example, the piece mentioned Neymar, who posted his WhatsApp communication with a woman who accused him of rape to his Facebook and Instagram account. Now, in that screenshot, he showed her name and nude photos of her. And because he's covered by X-Check, moderators were blocked from removing the content. So I'm sure he was trying to like fight the allegations, but in that, he disclosed content that obviously shouldn't be on the platform.
Quick apology to Doug the Pug. Doug the Pug is actually a dog, an actual dog that lives in Nashville in Tennessee, who has 13 million plus followers, apparently. It is a pug, a Chinese pug, the breed. And so it's basically like Instagram famous canine.
I need to follow Doug the Pug.
I do
follow raccoon Instagram accounts. They are hilarious.
Really?
Raccoons are like
follow little... Chulu and Duke. You know, my dogs have an Instagram now.
I do that. See, because raccoons to me, they're like little drunk people all the time. they're really constantly partying.
They really, really are.
So less than 10% of the content that X-Check flags to the company as needing attention actually gets reviewed, right? And most, and this is the part that was actually really interesting, most Facebook employees have the power to add users to the X-Check system for whitelisting status.
That's messed up.
That's a massive problem.
Yeah, of course.
Right, because then it becomes a thing like basically for any reason you start dropping people in there, all of a sudden your list of exclusives becomes...
It's like the bouncer at the club in college.
That's how you get to 5.8 million people or accounts.
I'm not on the list, but don't worry about it. I know this guy.
Exactly. Now, Facebook has acknowledged that X-Check and its downfalls years ago and told the journal that it's trying to terminate its whitelisting practice. Now, the company documents also show how Facebook intention to eradicate the system. A product manager proposed a plan to stop allowing Facebook employees to add new users to X-Check as a solution.
Think about that comment,
though. The company is, like, proposing to do that immediately? Like,
well, here's this is a legit question. Has Facebook gotten so big that they can't immediately take action on something? In other words, there's no dashboard where they're like, oh, let's just turn that button off. Has this thing gotten so big that in order for them to say, yeah, we're trying to wind that down, they may not know, like, you see what I'm saying? Like,
there's all the downstream repercussions of everything that could get impacted by that. Yeah, no, that's why, do you remember the what was their mantra?
Move fast and break things.
And break things? Yeah, that stopped being the mantra a long time ago.
Yeah. Well, Google's mantra was do no evil. Talk about that's going away a long time ago.
And in part because now it's such a massive platform that they really think about any kind of product upgrade. It really, they have to test it out, roll it out in batches and see how
right.
it actually
behaves. But my point is them saying, we're looking to shut this down. Like, they probably have to analyze, if we shut this down, then this thing will break and this thing will happen. And it's like, it takes 6 months to make a decision probably.
Yeah, that's, which is very sad, right? So anyways, courage or cringe, social platforms needing to give special consideration for influential users or lack of consistent application of content guidelines only adding to mistrust in these platforms.
Easy. It's got Facebook in the title. It's cringe. So that's easy. Show's over. Goodbye. No, it's cringe. But look, I can see an argument for something like, we want to give, because we think that even when they say outlandish things, because of who these people are, it has a bearing on the world. And we're going to reserve an amount of rules with maybe some stopgaps like they did for Trump for heads of state and heads of religions. Let's just say, I'm just throwing those two out there. Church and state. Heads of state, like the president of X, not senator from whatever. No. Not congresswoman from wherever. State assembly person. No. Presidents and like heads of religions. I could see a very limited universe of exceptions made for those people.
Right.
And even having some stopgaps beyond that, right? If you cross that, like, we'll let it go once or twice, but we're going to hammer you on the third time. Yeah. Everyone else, I think, should live by the same rules. And I can even see an argument that everyone should just have the same rules. Even there should be no limited or protected class. But I can concede that there might be that head of state, you know, concession or something like that.
Yeah.
Not 5.8 million people. And not the bouncer at the Facebook club for going like, yeah, I can get you on the list. Don't worry.
Yeah. And like being an influencer should not make you someone that gives you special rules of what you can create or not.
No.
Because to me, those would be actually the most dangerous people in terms of the things that they can say. In the case of Trump, I mean, the part of the challenge here is that I agree to some extent saying, hey, having a president be able to communicate at any point is really important. But there's also a case of like how far is too much? You know, like, I'm sure you saw this, right, with the recall election. Trump was talking about that this is going to be a stolen election, whatever it was, 2 days ago. Already. I'm like, dude, you guys aren't even, like, waiting for the results anymore. It's like, oh, what's the polling? Yeah. It's stolen. Hey, guys, it's stolen.
He's not even on social.
You're not even on social. You literally have put it out, like ex-president, like, faxing in his tweets. It was like, dude. At least wait for the at this point, it's like,
right. But what's wrong with my proposal, though? So, like, say somebody says this is stolen, and then you go, hey, we want people to hear what you have to say because you're a president, letting you know the next one you do like that, we're taking your thing down, and that's your special rule that nobody has. Anybody else who writes stolen, they're gone immediately. See what I'm saying? Like.
Right. I feel like they kind of did that, but the problem is that this group, it was like the bouncer, it's like the VIP area became the everyone area.
Yeah.
And that just doesn't work.
Velvet rope.
I think you have to be, thinking about it, I do like that idea of having a very, very small group of people that will fall under special consideration. And even then, that consideration should be very limited in terms of the use cases.
I think increasingly these platforms getting to a place of uniformity where they're like a utility, like electricity, like a phone. I think heading in that direction, in my opinion, the more I think about this, probably the better. But I still think like a limited universe of exceptions could make some sense, increasingly making less sense over time.
Sure.
But I can live with it, but I can't live with 6 million. So there you go.
There you go. So cringe as well.
Cringe across the board.
Facebook, cringe.
Easy. All right. Jesus, what's coming up next? Anything interesting?
I don't know. I don't know.
You don't know what's,
we'll see. We'll see
you don't what know what's happening in the future?
I do not know what happened in the future.
Episode 56, and with the same governor. We didn't even switch governors in California.
We didn't even talk about it. It was a landslide.
Yeah.
Well, wasn't even close.
But you know what's interesting about that? So having 4 out of 10 people basically say that they don't want you to be the governor, like they don't want you to have your job. Okay, it's a landslide, but it's kind of like second place is the first loser. In other words, it's not the kind of thing you write home about. Say, hey, by the way, I didn't get kicked out of the job that I was elected to do today. You know what I mean? It's not like you don't get to do a victory lap for not being recalled, in my opinion, after being recalled.
Yeah, I mean, the fact that it got there, you're right. That obviously, you know, that's not good. He's the first governor that went through an actual recall vote since 2013, 2003? Yeah, right, 2003. So last 18 years.
No, Schwarzenegger, right?
Yeah, exactly. With Gray Davis, right? Mm-hmm. So that's not great. Having said that...
Now what happened to Gray Davis? I never heard from him again.
Yeah, for sure. So having said that, I think the dynamic that we had talked about this before, right? One is you had, you know, in California is about, what, like 25%, give or take, Republicans around there, right? It's like a quarter, give or take. There was already a push to get him ousted, like, the second the guy walked in. So this is before COVID.
It was independence that was going to make the difference in this one.
It just got tons of steam. And the two things we talked about is this dinner at this French Laundry place, and then getting the 4-month extension almost at the same time to go out and get the additional signatures. But the best thing that happened, the best thing that happened are two things. One is Larry Elder was literally godsend for Gavin Newsom because it gave him a great person to point this to. So it stopped being a referendum on Gavin Newsom. It was to stop Larry Elder from becoming the governor.
Yeah, it was the way that...
So that was perfect
for
him.
It was Biden in office. It was like, look, nobody wants this guy, but it's better than this.
It's like a voting against rather than a voting for, right?
It is. It's a voting against, yeah.
That's one. And I really believe is that Governor Abbott in Texas and DeSantis in Florida are... Newsom should be sending them bottles of wine to both those guys. Say, hey, thanks for all the like great work this past few weeks on all this new legislature. Thank you, because you literally got me reelected. Because
got you not recalled. That's not reelected.
Yeah, no, I'm sorry. Yeah. Got me not recalled. But but that's why it was such a landslide. It was like, and you say you talk about like 30%, give or take, of people in
36.
You can still say, okay, 25% of that is people that are Republican. And also you got to think about how many people actually voted. That I don't know how similar it was, but. Yeah, there's some people definitely the independent that voted, you know, to recall him, but it's still relatively speaking, it's probably like most Republican and then some percentage of independents. And then everyone else went the other direction. It wasn't close. And the reason it wasn't close, when it was really close about a month ago, right? Because the polling about a month ago was like really, really close. Larry Elder kind of came to the scene. And then over the last month, what is all the things that have happened in Texas, right? You have anti-abortion laws, you have restrictions on voting, you have much more like loose gun laws. These are like at least three major policies, all of that are very conservative.
It's like California kryptonite.
Exactly. So you hear all that? Great. And then what's happening, and then with the Delta variant going up and what's happening in Florida? Great one, right? Because that's one of the things that you did see is that people were very for, and that was a little surprise to me, how people were actually so for the idea of the restrictions that Gavin Newsom had put in the state. As a matter of fact, there was a percentage that people had, like 80-something% of people were actually agreeing with him that they were the right ones or should be actually more strict.
I do agree with you.
That was actually super interesting. I thought it would be...
I do think it's a big win for the, you know, kind of vaccine mandate and all of those kind of issues that are on that side of the spectrum. We'll talk about that too on a show coming up. We have to, because that's a big ticket thing. But I agree that that was the case. All I'm saying is that not being... it's like being sent to the principal's office for like being like a class clown and not getting suspended and feeling good about it. It's like, you see what I'm saying? Like,
I agree with that. Yeah. That's
maybe good. I could think of a better analogy next time.
I was just hearing this. I was having a conversation yesterday with someone and they were saying like, hey, I think, you know, we're talking about for the next presidential election and basically some of the concerns that
Elder for president
that we have with Biden. And like, do you think that Trump runs again? And I'm like, look, if I'm Biden, I am hoping and wishing that Trump runs again. Because I think if that's literally the only reason why Biden gets reelected. It, once again, the anti-Trump vote. I think if you put anyone else that is competent and is like less sort of controversial, I think Biden loses right now.
Mm-hmm.
That's my POV on it.
Yeah. Well, interesting subject matter for a future show, Jesus. Awesome. All right. Anything else?
That's it.
All right. We'll see everybody again next week on another episode of TDR. If you enjoyed this episode of the Diversity Remix, please remember, first of all, to subscribe and help us to spread the word. Tell your friends, family, coworkers, and give us a 5-star review. We're available on Apple and Google Podcasts, Spotify, and everywhere else you get your listening fix. And lastly, please remember to stop by blackbrown.us, the creator of this podcast, and take a look at our work and our approach at the intersection of diversity and business. The Diversity Remix is produced by Leo Gomez, with production services by Jose Manuel Durquidi and Luis Diego Carranza and our friends at Juan Diego Network. The Diversity Remix is a production of Black Brown.